chastity and modesty. The fourth directive mentioned is that no one should even go near fornication. The reason stated for this is that it is open lewdness and a very dreadful practice. The implication is that no argument is required to prove its awfulness and lewdness. Human nature has always regarded it to be a grave sin and a terrible crime. It is an indubitable reality that the institution of family is as essential a need for a person as air and water are. This institution can only sustain on natural feelings and emotions. If the relationship between the spouses is permanent, if this aspect is missing, then a society can only consist of a herd of cattle which is devoid of natural and spiritual feelings and emotions. It cannot be founded on right footings. Maulana Abu al-Ala Maududi, died 1979, writes, "The fact that this act is immoral or a religious sin or against social norms is something which has been universally acknowledged in all times, and no one save a few people who have surrendered their intellect to base desires or who in their madness invent novel things and then philosophize them has differed in this regard. The reason for this universal consensus is that human nature itself requires that fornication be prohibited. The survival of human race and the establishment of a human society both require that a man and a woman should not be free to merely sexually gratify themselves and then split away. On the contrary, the relationship between them should be of a permanent contract in which they remain sincere to one another. A relationship which is known and acknowledged in the society and is also given protection by it. Without this, human race cannot survive a single day because a child needs several years of care and affection for his upbringing, and a woman single-handedly can never be able to bear this responsibility unless the man who is responsible for bringing the child into existence is ready to support and help her. Similarly, without such a contract, human society also cannot remain intact because society itself has been created through the union of a man and a woman in the form of a family and then through relationships between various families with one another. If a man and a woman, while disregarding a family setup, come together to merely sexually gratify themselves for some time, human beings will end up dispersed from one another. The roots of collective life will be severed, and the very foundation on which the edifice of the society was built would be razed to the ground. For these reasons, an informal relationship between a man and a woman, which is not based on a contract of sincerity that is known and recognized in the society, is against human nature. Consequently, man has always regarded fornication as a grave folly and an act of great immorality, and in religious terms, an atrocious sin. It is this very terrible nature of fornication, because of which the Almighty has not merely forbidden it, He has asked us to not even go near it. This means that one should keep away from things that may lead to it or may ultimately entice a person to it. The etiquette of gender interaction mentioned in Surah Nur is stated for these very reasons. A summary of this etiquette is that a man and a woman, with regard to their physical and psychological needs, should guard their gazes and properly cover their private parts and should not do something that rouses sexual emotions. The reason for this is that when Satan wants to give currency to fornication in a society, he first of all begins from these places. It is evident from the Quran that it was through this very way that he had attacked Adam and Eve. Children of Adam, let not Satan tempt you again the way he had expelled your parents from the orchard in which they were living, stripping them of their garments in order to reveal their private parts to them. He and his associates see you from where you cannot see them. Indeed, we have made such devils associates of those who do not profess faith. Surah 7, verse 27. What sort of an attack is this? Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, "He first strips a person of his apparel of piety and virtue. The apparel which the Almighty had blessed him with, together with his real apparel, to elevate his inner self. When this inner apparel is taken off, modesty and chastity, which are the actual motives for the real apparel, fade away. Then this real apparel starts becoming burdensome. Immodesty and profligacy induce a person to expose body parts which hold an attraction for the opposite gender, parts whose concealment is a requirement of human nature. Then comes fashion to support this tendency. it provokes a person to wear clothes in such a bizarre way that he or she appears to be naked in spite of being adorned with clothes. And in this way, concealment of the body, the very objective of clothes, is sacrificed. The only thing left in these clothes now is embellishment, and the real objective is now to enhance the degree of nudity as much as possible. Then gradually human intellect is overwhelmed, and nudity is now dubbed as culture, and covering the body is considered to be an old-fashioned act which exudes abhorrence. Then educated Rufians come to the scene and present the philosophy in the light of history that nudity is real human nature. Clothing has become in vogue because of restrictions of customs and etiquette. It is at this stage that shamelessness overcomes people, and the whole society is poisoned with lust and licentiousness. Reference Amin Hassan Islahi, Tadabburi Quran, Volume 3, 246. On this very basis, popularizing fornication and creating opportunities which lead to it are regarded a crime by the Almighty. The Quran says that when the hypocrites and miscreants of Medina in the time of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam adopted these ways, the Almighty said, "Indeed, those who like shamelessness and lust to spread among Muslims shall be sternly punished in this life and in the life to come. They deserve only this, and God knows them, but you know not." Surah 24, verse 19. For this very objective, the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam forbade Muslim women from putting on pungent perfumes when going out, from sitting alone with men, and from traveling alone. Reference Al-Bukhari Al-Jami Al-Sahih 175, 496, Numbers 1088, 3006, and Muslim Al-Jami Al-Sahih 187, 566, Numbers 997 and 3272. When people asked about the brother-in-law, the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam told them that sitting alone with him is tantamount to death. The wisdom in the directive of taking a mahram relative along in long journeys is no different. Turning away one's gaze from ladies after the first sight is also for this purpose. Certain types of music have been prohibited for the very reason that they may lead a person to this sin. The Prophet ﷺ is reported to have said that the children of Adam necessarily get some share from fornication. Thus, ogling women is the fornication of the eye, lustful talk is the fornication of the tongue, amusing oneself with such talk is the fornication of the ears, touching and walking for this purpose is the fornication of the hands and the feet. Then the heart and the mind show their yearning, and one's private parts sometimes confirm this and sometimes negate it. All these directives are meant to nip the evil of fornication in its bud. Sanctity of human life. The fifth directive is that no one should kill anyone. This is a mention of the sanctity of human life, which it always has had as per morality and religion. The Quran has informed us that prior to this, the Israelites were also given this directive, and the Almighty had ordained that killing one human being is like killing whole mankind. This directive has been preserved in the Talmud in these very words even today. The Quran has referred to it in Surah Maidah in the following words: "That was why we laid it down for the Israelites that he who killed a human being, without the latter being guilty of killing another or of spreading anarchy in the land, should be looked upon as if he killed all mankind, and he who saved one life should be looked upon as if he saved all mankind." Surah 5, verse 32. It is evident from the above mentioned directive that the life of a human being can only be taken in two circumstances: when a person has killed someone, or when a person, while rebelling against the collective system, goes after the life, wealth, or honor of others. The words "spreading anarchy in the land" refer to this latter practice. Apart from these two circumstances, every killing is an unjustified act, the punishment of which is eternal hell, according to the Quran, in Surah 25, verses 68-69. Muslims who perpetrate this crime against other Muslims are warned thus by the Quran: "And he who intentionally kills a believer, his reward is hell. He shall abide therein forever, and the wrath and the curse of God are upon him. He has prepared for him a dreadful doom." Surah 4, verse 93. The Quran has also clarified that the perpetrators of this crime will not only have to face God, they will also have to reckon with the heirs of the slain person, and God has given them full authority in this regard. And no court of justice can show any leniency to the murderer without the consent of his heirs. Its responsibility is that if they insist on qisas, it should help them and should implement with full force whatever they want. However, this does not at all mean that if at some place a formal government does not exist, and the matter of qisas is solely left to the discretion of the heirs of the accused, then they, in their capacity as heirs, should exceed the limits, and for example, slay others besides the slayer in frenzy of revenge, or out of prejudice for their status and superiority demand the execution of a free person in place of a slave or a man in place of a woman. Demand the execution of a free person in place of a slave, or a man in place of a woman, or kill the criminal by torturing him, or take out their venom on his dead body, or adopt those methods of killing which have been prohibited by the Almighty. It is evident from this that on the Day of Judgment, the slain person shall have the same authority, and without his consent, the slayer will not be granted any leniency. Misappropriating the wealth of orphans. The sixth directive is that the wealth of orphans should not be misappropriated. The words of this directive are the same as those of fornication earlier. Do not approach the wealth of orphans except for their welfare and betterment. The implication is that one should only use the wealth of the orphans for their development and protection, and this too should be done till the time when orphans reach maturity and can be entrusted with their wealth. In Surah Nisa, the Almighty has given certain guidelines in this matter. However, since they relate to the Sharia, they shall be mentioned in the chapter The Social Sharia of this book. Here, this much should remain clear, that in the given verse what one has been prohibited regarding orphans is a grave crime, and one should not consider it to be trivial. Consequently, the Quran says, "Indeed those who devour the property of orphans unjustly swallow fire into their bellies, and soon shall they be cast into the raging fire of hell." Surah 4 verse 10. Keeping promises. The seventh directive is that promises should be kept at all costs. The Quran here says that one shall be held accountable for promises. In Surah Baqarah, this directive has been mentioned with great stress and emphasis in the following words. "And when they make promises, they keep them." Surah 2 verse 177. Promises here imply all kinds and sorts of promises. Imam Amin Hassan Islahi says, "Keeping promises includes all small and big obligations, whether they are related to God or to His creation, whether they come into existence through written means or whether through some relation and association, whether they are declared or are considered to be understood in a good society. We are tied in some sort of a contract with God and the Prophet ﷺ, our father and mother, our wife and kids, with our near and distant relatives, our clan and family, our neighbors and neighborhood, teachers and students, masters and servants, and with our peoples and nations. It is an essential requirement of piety and fulfillment of oaths that we fulfill these rites. In other words, the real spirit of keeping promises is fulfillment of rights, and fulfillment of rights encompasses all big and small obligations." Reference Amin Hassan Islahi, the Tadabburi Quran, Volume 1, 429. At some other instances in the Quran, for example, Surah 23 verse 8 and Surah 70 verse 32, this directive of keeping promises is mentioned with the same emphasis. At the time of armed jihad also, the most important directive which is stated in the Quran is this keeping of promises. Surah Tawbah is the Surah of Punishment. In it, the Prophet ﷺ and the Muslims have been directed to end their treaties with the idolaters of Arabia and launch the final onslaught. However, this much has been clearly stated in it, in Surah 9 verse 4, that treaties which are time-bound must be honored till the time period expires. Similarly, in Surah Anfal, it has been stated that if a nation with whom Muslims are bound in a pact is oppressing the Muslims, then these Muslims cannot be helped in breach of this pact. The Quran says, "And to those who accepted faith but did not migrate to Medina, you owe no duty of protection until they migrate, but if they seek your help in religion, it is your duty to help them against a people with whom you have a treaty, and in reality, Allah sees what you do." Surah 8 verse 72. Honesty in weighing. The eighth directive is that things should be weighed and measured with honesty. The Almighty says that He has set the earth and the heavens on a scale, and thus it is necessary that a person in his circle should remain just and measure with the right scale and weights. The Quran says, "And He raised high the heavens, and set the scale of all things that you, Also in your circle of authority, do not transgress that scale. Give just weight and full measure. Surah 55, verses 7 to 9. It is evident from these verses that this is a very important directive, and in its essence is actually a corollary of the scale of justice on which this world has been created. Thus, if anyone deviates from it, it means that his conception of justice and fairness has become defective and he actually does not believe in a just God. After this, obviously the economic and social systems of the society are shaken from their bases and no ingredient of the society remains in its place. The people of the Prophet Shu'aib sallallahu alaihi wasallam were involved in such malpractices. At more than one instance, his advice and sermon to his people in this regard is mentioned in the Quran. At one place it is said, "Give just measure and defraud none. Weigh with the right scales and do not cheat your fellow men of what is rightly theirs, and do not spread anarchy in the land." Surah 26 verses 181 to 183. Adulteration in things is also a similar case. If a person mixes water and milk, or sand in sugar, or barley and wheat, he commits the same crime because even if he weighs accurately, he is not giving the buyer in full what he is buying. This is like usurping the rights of others, for which he will have to face grave consequences, both in this world and in that to come. Thus the Quran has said, "Give full measure, when you measure, and weigh with correct scales." This is better and fairer as far as the consequences are concerned. Following speculations, the ninth directive is that one should not get after things one has no knowledge of. The Quran has warned us that one must not take this directive lightly, because the faculties of sight, hearing, and intellect shall one day be held accountable before God. The implication of this directive, that it is not right for a Muslim to make bad estimations about other Muslims, or make allegations against others, or take some action against others without proper knowledge of what the matter is, or spread rumors merely on the basis of speculation, or form a view about God's being and attributes and his directives merely on the basis of conjecture and guesswork and unending analogies. In Surah Hujurat, some of these things have been mentioned with this clarity of prohibition. Believers, if an evildoer brings you a piece of news, find out its true status, lest you inflict harm on others unwittingly, and then regret your action. Surah 49, verse 6. Believers, avoid being overly speculative, for some speculations are a blatant sin, and do not spy on one another. Surah 49, verse 12. The first thing which is mentioned in these verses is that if an evildoer informs us about something, we should not take action until we have thoroughly found out what the truth of the matter is, for we may take some action in frenzy and rage and later regret what we do. It is evident from this directive that if the informant is an unknown person or someone about whom it is not known whether he is a good person or an evil one, the truth about him must be ascertained. On this very basis, the Muhaddithun have researched into the life and times of people who narrate the words or deeds of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and if they were not able to access the details of a narrator, they rejected his narrative by regarding him to be an unknown person. The second thing which is stated here is that one should not indulge in excessive conjecture, because certain conjectures are blatant sins. Imam Amin Hassan Islahi, while explaining this, writes, "It is but natural for good or bad thoughts to arise in one's heart about people whom a person encounters in life. It is these thoughts which establish or sever a person's relationship with another. Viewed thus, it is these thoughts which make and break relationships in a society. On the basis of this importance which thoughts occupy, a person should not carelessly accept or reject them. On the contrary, he should be very sharp and alive to them. In this regard, the guidance provided by Islam to its followers is that a Muslim must always think well of others unless it is proven to him that some person is not worthy of this. Thinking well of a person is an obvious requirement of the brotherhood of faith on which Islam has founded its society and which has been explained earlier. On the other hand, if a person adopts the attitude of entertaining and harboring all sorts of ill-founded thoughts that come to mind, then the example of such a person is that of a hunter who becomes so blind in his obsession for catching fish that he also catches snake. Obviously, there is a great possibility for a person who becomes blind in his obsession for catching fish to end up losing his own life one day as a result. The Quran has stopped Muslims from this very danger that one must not start conjecturing too much, because certain conjectures are blatant sins which may doom a person. The guidance which emerges from this directive is that a person should not become so mentally sick as to think ill of others. On the contrary, he should always think well of others. If the deed or words of a person induce him to think ill of him, he should try as far as he can to make a good justification, if it can be made. He should only think contrarily when he is not able to make any sound justification. It is better to think positively of a person who deserves to be thought of negatively than to think negatively of a person who deserves to be thought of positively. Reference Amin Hassan Islahi, Tadabburi Quran, Volume 7, 509. The third thing which is mentioned is that one should not be nosy and inquisitive about others. Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, "Here the prohibition actually relates to being inquisitive for an evil purpose. In other words, here the intention of a person is to try to find some fault or mistake in the private life of another person and have access to the secrets of his family and family life. Sometimes, the motive of this probing is jealousy, for it soothes a person to find out such facts about someone he considers to be his rival. At other times, the motive is hatred and animosity. He wants to humiliate another person by informing others of his faults. This latter tendency has now become a profession to which newspaper journalism has given a great impetus. Some journalists are in perpetual search of scandals, and the journalist who is considered to be the most successful is the one who is able to lay his hands on a scandal in the private life of a famous person, which makes his newspaper or journal sell like hotcakes. Such spying and probing is counter to mutual sympathy and brotherhood, which are the foundations of an Islamic society. For this reason, Muslims have been stopped from indulging in them. On the other hand, probing which a Muslim does to find out the circumstances of another person so that he can help him in his difficulties and needs, or the spying and probing which an Islamic state does to be fully informed about the circumstances of its citizens, is neither implied here nor is it prohibited. On the contrary, such spying is a very virtuous act on the part of a neighbor, so that he is aware of the circumstances and problems which his neighbor is encountering and is able to help him out. Similarly, for a state, this attitude is not just an act of virtue, it is in fact its responsibility to arrange to be informed of the good or bad circumstances of its citizens so that it is able to properly discharge its duties. Reference Ibid, Volume 7, 510. Pride and Vanity. The tenth directive is that no one should walk with pride and vanity on God's earth. It is thus said that howsoever much a person may strike the earth with his feet, he will not be able to rent it asunder, and howsoever much a person may walk while raising his head, he will not be able to reach the heights of the mountains. Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, "The implied meaning is that what is the meaning of showing pride and vanity in the earth made by God, the God whose glory and grandeur one witnesses in the vast expanse of the earth that he has spread out, on which one's status is not even that of an ant or an insect, and the God who has created these towering mountains before which one's status is not even that of a squirrel. One should try to recognize one's status and always surrender oneself before the majesty and splendor of God." Reference Muslim Al-Jami'a Sahih 54, Numbers 265-266. Such a gait obviously reflects one's inner self. Wealth, authority, beauty, knowledge, power, and other similar things produce pride and vanity in a person. Each of these produces a specific type of pride in one's gait, showing that his heart is devoid of the perception of serving God, and there is no concept in it of God's glory and greatness. The heart which has the perception of serving God and of his greatness only beats in the chests of people who have humility. Instead of walking arrogantly, they walk with their heads bent. Thus, walking with pride and vanity is a very bad trait, and its punishment is very grave too. The Prophet ﷺ is reported to have said that the person who has pride even to the measure of a mustard seed will not enter paradise. Reference Muslim Al-Jami' Al-Sahih 54, Number 265 and 266. He has also said that honor is the lower fabric of the Almighty and greatness is his upper fabric. He who competes with him regarding these will be punished. reference Ibid 1144, number 6680. Here it should remain clear that pride and vanity are not merely reflected in one's gait, they are evident in one's conversation, clothes, appearance, and behavior as well. Consequently, the Quran says, "And do not become indifferent to people, nor walk proudly on the earth. God does not like the arrogant, and the one who expresses vanity, and be modest in your gait, and keep your voice low. Indeed, the most hideous of voices is the braying of the ass." Surah 31, verses 18-19. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam on this very basis has prohibited the use of all things which reflect affluence or are a means of show and pomposity or are instrumental in overawing others or belong to the mannerisms of rogues and ruffians. For this very reason, he forbade the use of silk, making covers from expensive hides, and eating in utensils made of gold and silver. Reference Al-Bukhari Al-Jami' Al-Sahih 998-1029 and Muslim Al-Jami' Al-Sahih 923. So much so, he even urged people having short beards and large mustaches to give up this arrogant appearance and said that one should satisfy one's passion by increasing the length of the beard, but mustaches should be trim in all circumstances. Reference Al-Bukhari Al-Jami' Al-Sahih 1036 and Muslim Al-Jami' Al-Sahih 125. He is reported to have said, "He who wore a dress to show his status, the Almighty will clothe him with the dress of humiliation on the Day of Judgment, and then fire shall be ignited in it." Reference Ibn Majah, Sunan, Volume 4, 186. He is similarly reported to have said, "On the Day of Judgment, God will not wish to see a person who walked conceitedly by dragging his legwear." Reference Al-Bukhari Al-Jami' Al-Sahih 1020-1021 and Muslim Al-Jami' Al-Sahih 933. Moreover, this mental state becomes a source of great sins. Consequently, it is this conceit and arrogance which is instrumental in deliberately denying the truth, in considering oneself superior to others on the basis of color, creed, and race, in considering others to be inferior and making fun of them, in censuring others, in calling them with bad names, and in scandalizing the faults of others in their absence. God has strictly forbidden all these. Those who evade the truth and reject it in arrogance are warned that they must not consider their sin to be trivial. Their punishment is that the doors of paradise are closed for them. Hell shall be their abode from all sides, and they shall abide in it forever. Indeed, those who denied our revelations and evaded them in arrogance, the gates of heavens shall not be opened for them, and neither shall they be able to enter paradise, except if a camel is able to pass through the eye of a needle. This is their punishment, and in this manner do we punish the criminals. Hell shall be their bedding, and the flames of hell shall be their covering, and in this way do we punish the evildoers. Surah 7, verses 40-41. People who show conceit and vanity on their lineage and ancestry are cautioned that all human beings are the progeny of Adam and Eve. Whites are not superior to blacks, nor blacks superior to whites, and similarly, Arabs are not superior to non-Arabs, and non-Arabs are not superior to Arabs. In the sight of God, the status and nobility of a person is not founded on the basis of his family, clan, color, or creed. It is founded on the basis of his consciousness towards God. Only that person will be respected in his presence who is the most God-fearing and lives within the limits specified by him, even if he belongs to a low and unknown family. And he who is arrogant and conceited shall definitely be humiliated even though he belongs to a family of high status and pedigree. This division of mankind in families is merely to give people identity. Just as God has distinguished people from one another on the basis of features, color, and stature so that they can identify and recognize one another, similarly, dividing them into families and clans is meant to serve this very purpose. It has no significance beyond this. You people, we have created you from one man and one woman, and divided you into tribes and clans that you might get to know one another. The noblest of you in God's sight is he who is the most God-conscious. Indeed, God is all-knowing and wise. Surah 49, verse 13. People who make fun of others are told that in the sight of God, a person is respectable or disreputable on the basis of his faith and deeds, and their true weight too shall be indicated by the Almighty's balance of justice. A person who considers himself to be noble in this world may end up in humiliation on the Day of Judgment, and a person who is considered lowly may be rewarded greatly in paradise. Hence, every Muslim must remain aware that according to the Quran, in Surah 49 verse 10, once he has entered the fold of faith, he has entered the universal brotherhood of Muslims in which every Muslim is a brother to another. It is not befitting for him at all to make fun of others, ridicule and censure them while thinking them to be inferior to him. Believers, let no man make fun of another man, who may perhaps be better than himself, and let no woman make fun of another woman, who may perhaps be better than herself. Surah 49 verse 11.